Hey, everybody, it's Sunny. Just as a heads up, this episode came out, you know, like a month ago. Asteroid City, it's on VOD now. You can watch it at home on your TV. We also did a pretty fun Wes Anderson draft bonus episode over at the Patreon at subbeacon.com. You'll easily find us. I thought it was a lot of fun. People seem to enjoy it. You missed the chance to vote on the winner, but I think you'll be pleasantly surprised by the actual episode itself. You won't miss that chance if you go sign up at the Patreon. You make this podcast sustainable. We don't do ads or anything like that, except for this one you're listening to right now, asking you to please be like our good friend who finally signed up after months of years of listening for free. He was like, I got to get that Oppenheimer episode. Well, that's not coming here for a little while. So, you know, if you want to hear about Oppenheimer, Barbenheimer, the sensation of the summer, best box office in years, you got to go to the Patreon, subbeacon.com, go sign up. It's fun. You'll enjoy it. We all have a good time.
What do those pulses indicate?
What? Oh, the beeps and blips? We don't know.
Some of our information about outer space may no longer be completely accurate. Anyway, there's still only 9 planets in the solar system as far as we know, Billy?
Except now there's an alien.
What's happening now?
I don't know.
I don't like the way that guy looked at us, the alien.
How did he look?
Like we're doomed.
Maybe we are.
Welcome to the Sub Beacon. I am your co-host, Mike Warren. Joining me, as always, are my two co-hosts, Jonathan V. Last and Sunny Bunch. Go to subbeacon.com, become a member, subscribe, join the conversation, get these episodes the day they come out, and you can even get those bonus episodes, but you got to sign up at subbeacon.com. We're going to be talking about Asteroid City, the latest Wes Anderson movie, later in the show. But first, let's see how everyone's doing. JVL, what's going on with you, big guy?
I want to yield my time because, again, I think we've just crept. The show keeps expanding. I want it to be,
but it's what the people want.
Tighter,
JVL.
Do they?
The show should be 50 minutes dude chatting, 10 minutes show talk. Movie talk is my understanding from
now,
what I hear
from people. You can't give them everything they want. You know, you got to leave them wanting more. So maybe not 50 minutes, maybe 45 minutes.
But I think they should have called Oppenheimer Dudes Chattin', because that is a dudes chattin' movie. Let me tell you, we're going to talk
but
about
we're
that.
Not talking about that this
next.
Week.
We're going to talk about that next week. But
I will simply say this. I this morning went to read a profile of Robert Oppenheimer from Life magazine in 1949, and I couldn't even read it because I spent 45 minutes just paging through the PDF of the magazine, looking at the advertisements. And man, it is like a time capsule for a different America. And the one thing that really, I mean, aside from all of the absolutely casual racism, especially about Native Americans, in the advertisements, which, there was an ad for Van Hoosen shirts saying that they come in brave new colors with brave in exclamation marks and a Anglo gentleman in a Van Hoosen wearing a headdress. I was surprised at how much TNA was in these ads. Lot of ads featuring women in bras, brassieres.
It's post-war, baby. There's a hunger.
I would say if you conceive of this as a Victorian sort of era, that's not the case.
I mean, it's literally in the middle of the baby boom.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's
a lot
reason.
Of that. A lot of ads with there's an ad for silverware with pictures of women being carried over the threshold, and ad copy about how the one of the greatest woman moments in any woman's life is being carried over the threshold of her new home as a bride and, you know, register for sterling silverware and that sort of thing. And
were these all illustrated ad, or mostly illustrated ads?
Mostly illustrated. Some photographs. There was a feature in it where Life got 12 young actresses together and did a photo session. It's actually really neatly laid out where they asked each of them to like do an emotion and they took a, you know, here's angry.
Right.
And I had never heard of 11 of these actresses and one of them is Marilyn Monroe. So this is pre like Marilyn Monroe blowing up as a sex bomb.
Is she still Norma Jean or
she's listed as Marilyn Monroe.
Jean Baker.
Anyway, the whole thing was fascinating. And I'm going to throw one other fascinating thing at you. I have just started an intellectual biography of John Maynard Keynes, which is 1,000 times more fascinating than you would think. So you would think like, oh boy, who wants to read an intellectual history of an economist?
Right.
But let me just start with this. John Maynard Keynes was exclusively gay his entire life until the age of 38. At which point he fell in love with a Russian ballerina and never went back to dudes again. That's a strange thing.
That is a strange thing.
Isn't it?
Are you sure it's not a sort of British schoolboy kind of situation?
No. Oh, no. No, 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 no. This is when I say this was not just like British schoolboy stuff. I mean, he was gay all through his adult. And in fact, when he took up with this Russian ballerina, his friends in the Bloomsbury set, including Virginia Woolf, thought that it was ridiculous and they didn't understand it. They're like, what is Maynard doing with this woman? He doesn't climb up that tree. And anyway, utterly fascinating. John Maynard Keynes also 6'7", which at the time, early turn of the 20th century, is enormous. One of the tallest people notable not for being tall. This is a funny Steve Saylor, who of course is problematic in so many ways, but used to have a funny list of extremely tall people who nobody knows were extremely tall because they were notable for something else. And the top of his list, I think, was always Michael Crichton, who's like 6'10".
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, John Maynard Keynes should also be on that list. There. That's what I'm up to.
On that topic, I will say that like the most striking thing when I saw Michael Crichton at the American Enterprise Institute, he came there to talk State of Fear, I think it was.
Yeah.
You know, back in 2004, it was either late 2004 or early 2005 because I was at Roll Call at the time. I remember going to this thing and just being like, oh, I'm gonna go see Michael. I like Michael Crichton. I'm gonna go hear him talk. And the thing I was most struck by was like, who is this giant lurch? Oh my God, it's Michael Crichton.
Right.
He's an enormous man.
People who are 6'10" are notable for being 6'10". Not that. Yeah. So it's
right.
The book is the Price of Peace. And I cannot recommend it highly enough.
All right. Then. We're recommending books. This is a high level dudes chat. We're recommending intellectual histories.
Been reading books actually. No. As long as we're talking about books. No, I just read the Oppenheimer biography that the movie is based on. I mean, I'm audiobooking the BlackBerry.
I was midway through that as well. It's awesome, isn't it?
It's really interesting. I mean, you had said something. I can't remember if we talked about this on the show, JVL, but you had said something that you were like actually kind of annoyed at the movie because it's so different than from what happens in the book. And I totally understand that. Like, it definitely like...
Yeah, you yelled at me when I said that. You were like, JVL, you're wrong.
No. Well, no, what I said was it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And that's still very true. I don't think it actually matters. BlackBerry is a fine and interesting movie on its own. But it is very interesting just to have seen Oppenheimer after having read Oppenheimer and now to listen to BlackBerry, this BlackBerry book, after having watched BlackBerry. Because it's a striking difference between like a director who is telling a very specifically a story about history that weaves his thematic obsessions into the actual story. And somebody else who is just like, I got a story I want to tell, and I'm going to use the bare bones of this BlackBerry stuff to to kind of make the point I want to make, which I think I look again, you can go down. You can look at basically any movie about making anything and be like, this movie's about making movies. And that is basically exactly how I feel, you know, now having, again, the difference between having seen Blackberry and thought of it as like, oh, it's a story about, you know, business versus creativity. Now I'm like, oh, this is very specifically a movie about making movies and not a movie about making Blackberries.
Give me 30 seconds on Oppenheimer. Because the early reviews I've said are so gobsmacking that I'm a little concerned that my expectations are too high.
Like I said, it's basically, it really is dudes chatting the movie. Like, the movie is 3 hours. The movie is 3 hours of men talking to each other about, like, science stuff.
Ooh. Guys being
almost
dudes.
Exclusively. Like, guys science stuff.
I'm going to have to wear a trench coat to this movie so I can rub one out.
They're also talking a little bit about, like, commie stuff, but it's mostly science stuff.
And commie stuff, too.
And then the topping on the cake is there's bureaucratic DC infighting stuff.
Oh,
the whole last hour is basically Robert Downey Jr. as Louis Strauss, basically like having a bureaucratic knife fight with Oppenheimer and his supporters and trying to destroy his credibility. I'm very curious to see what the cinema score on this movie is. I think the praise has possibly been a little excessive. I've seen people call it the best movie of the 21st century. It's not that. But it is. It's very good. And it really is. I mean, it literally is just 3 hours of guys talking to each other about science stuff. And it never gets boring because it's interwoven extremely delicately. And it moves. It just has pace to it. It zips along. It goes from place to place. I like it a lot. I like it a lot.
Does it leave you shaking? Were you shaking when you left the theater, the way Variety says?
No, I was. Somebody's
jaded. Nothing makes
you
shake.
Much less so, frankly, than Interstellar, which I have always found like a very moving movie. That the closing of that movie to be incredibly moving. Or some of the other Nolan movies. This actually,
Give me a greater than, lesser than sign with Tenet.
It's better than Tenet. It's a very different sort of movie, though. It's better than Tenet, but it is. I mean, Tenet's an action movie.
By different, you can hear the people talking in this movie?
Mostly. There's no. There is the whole explanation of how atomic devices works does take place on a catamaran.
Oh,
so you
okay.
have to figure that out.
Yeah,
fantastic. Have you seen Barbie?
I have not seen Barbie yet. So I am seeing Barbie. By the time people are listening to this, I will probably be seated in the theater for Barbie. I'm not seeing it till Friday morning, at like 10 Central Time. So I have to do like 2 days of work today. We're taping this on Thursday, so I can actually go to see the movie. And whatever. But I haven't seen it yet. Barbie's going to make a ton of money, by the way. Maybe we'll talk about this in box office.
Tracking at 100, right?
Well,
yeah. So the tracking has turned around on that one. I had mentioned a couple weeks back that the tracking, like, there was high awareness, but low interest, which is a very bad thing. But that has all turned around. So
I have to say that I can't remember a movie that has gotten this much cultural buzz. Is not even quite the word, but I assume this is all just marketing done at the elite level. But the extent to which every magazine cover, every senator, every person on Threads and Twitter, everybody is like talking about Barbie in ways that make me feel like they're getting compensated for it almost. Right.
Barbie fever.
Have you guys picked up on that too? That it's like weird.
Yeah, it's like you can't, it's like somebody flipped a switch and all of a sudden we have to talk about Barbie. I mean, but this is, I mean, I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole here, but like, I've noticed this about a lot of things, in the past couple of years. And the most recent being, and again, I don't want to like go down into the details of it, but like a few days before we taped this, like there was this whole kind of national, obsession with this story about this young woman in Alabama who like disappeared on the side of the highway. Are you guys familiar with this? And then she like, showed up.
No idea what you're talking about.
No idea.
She showed up at her house. So nobody, but like literally every woman in America was talking about it. It was like this woman who like disappeared. It was all over social media. People were talking about it and she showed up and there's some questions about whether she actually disappeared or if it was a hoax, but that's not the point of it. The point of being, like the women in my life, people I work with, and of course my wife and all these things, like everybody was talking about it and talking about how everybody else was talking about it. And it's sort of, I guess it's virality. And, but it seemed to like have come out of nowhere. A switch was flipped. And that seems to be what happens with Barbie too. But it makes me think there's some,
well, the Barbie
with you,
thing,
money behind
No, the Barbie thing makes sense because what happens is you have a movie that's coming out that has a huge advertising campaign that has all the stars are talking about it. So there's video clips everywhere. There's, you know, there's premieres, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, like, this is just good movie PR is what it comes down to. And it helps that, like, PR. Barbie is like a mainstay of American culture for the last 70 years, right? Like Barbie is identifiable with America and American culture in a way that very few objects are, right? Like Ford trucks and apple pie, I guess. I don't know.
I was too young to sort of get it, but is there a parallel to the Barbie furor to 1989 and Batman, in the sense that it's like this sort of like hugely, again, popular and well-known cultural thing, and they've like finally made a movie about it.
That's possible.
I don't know. It's possible. I don't know. Yeah. I've been trying to think about what other parallel things there are like this.
The other thing which impresses me so much about this campaign is that they're doing it without the actors. Because of the strike, actors can't do publicity for movies. And so,
but they've already done all the publicity, though. That's the point.
No, they did.
They've already done all the publicity.
It would be helpful in the final 2 weeks to have like Margot Robbie and Ryan Gosling out there, and they're doing this without that. It's very impressive. However they did it, whether they're just paying influencers or what, they're kudos to them. I hope the movie's great.
Yep. All right. So should we move on to box office?
No, you didn't tell us about your weekend, Michael.
There's nothing. Well, okay.
How about the sexual deviant softball?
So now there's nothing to say there. I flubbed the first play of the first game on Sunday, and it led to like the worst inning that we played all season. So we lost that first game, but we won the next game, so it's okay. But what you guys were talking about books, and it did trigger a thought in me, which is that I have started reading with my oldest. I've started reading out loud with him. He's been asking for this. I've started reading out loud The Lord of the Rings to him. And so that's been kind of an interesting experience because we've read The Hobbit. And so he was familiar with this. And so it's like, I can't remember, you know, when I didn't know like what the story of The Lord of the Rings was, you know, it's sort of like not knowing, like remembering when I didn't know what the Star Wars story was. But it's been interesting to kind of watch him pick up on things as the story kind of takes this idea of like, oh yeah, remember that ring from The Hobbit that he found with that creepy guy Gollum and all the stuff? Yeah, that's what this whole book is going to be about. And like watching him sort of pick up on that, and he said something. So like the first chapter of the book is very like lighthearted, and you know, it's all about like hobbits and Bilbo's birthday and blah, blah, blah. But there's this one scene, which they do pretty well in the movie as well, which is like, where like Gandalf, the wizard's like, hey, maybe you should leave that ring behind. And Bilbo's like, no, you want it for yourself, blah, blah, blah. And so
did
like,
you do the voices?
Do not take me for some conjurer of cheap tricks.
I'm not trying to rob you. I'm trying to help you.
That was very good, Michael.
He doesn't say any of that stuff in the book, by the way. But I do some of the voices, just to like the kids like that when I do that. So
do you sing the sung passages? So when Tom Bombadil, you haven't gotten there yet.
We haven't gotten there yet.
Singing, have you gotten to Tom Bombadil
are you
yet?
Are you going to sing that, or are you going to read it as if it's poetry? Read it as if it's
poetry. I probably read it as if it's poetry. I think I made up a stupid little tune for the for Bilbo's walking song.
Father of the year.
Goes ever on, or whatever. When you I probably stole the Howard Shore theme. It was like in my head or something.
When you get to Tom Bombadil, are you going to explain that Tom Bombadil is no good? That he's a garbage, neutral peacenik
in a time
of crisis?
No, because it's more complicated than that.
It's not more complicated than that. Tom Bombadil is garbage.
Well, hold on.
Tom Bombadil refused to do the thing that needed to be done.
Guys, I can do 15 minutes on this just listening to the two of you right now. Tell me more about your Tom. I am dead serious. I would like to hear, Sonny, your case against Tom Bombadil and then Michael's defense of Tom Bombadil.
No. It's funny. I actually never had strong feelings about Tom Bombadil except for like a vague sense of annoyance at that section in the book, and also like a vague annoyance at the character who, like, again, is this kind of very powerful figure that does not take his responsibility seriously in the face of great evil. But there's a whole cult of Tom Bombadil on the internet. There are people who are like super into, like, and I can't tell how ironic it is or what, but like anytime Tom Bombadil comes up, you get like 50 people in your mentions on Twitter who are like, Tom Bombadil was a merry old soul. And I'm like, no, fuck him. Put him in prison for being an idiot. That's what I think you should do with Tom Bombadil. Put him in a cell. Never let him out.
All right. I can promise you that none of those people are ironic.
Yeah,
their
it's not
love
ironic.
Of Tom Bombadil. Michael, please, with the defense.
I wasn't prepared to defend Tom Bombadil. And like, I kind of sometimes feel the way Sonny does too. So like, I'm not like a full-on Tom Bombadil defender, but it's like a little more.
You're not a Bombadillin.
I'm not a Bombadil. No. But like, it's his inclusion in the story is odd and weird, but also interesting because he existed beforehand outside of the Lord of the Rings, and Tom like kind of features in these poems that Tolkien wrote. And so he kind of has like, he's kind of makes his way into the story in the way Tolkien describes, like how he brought him in. And he actually does serve some important purposes in the book. He doesn't just stand by. I mean, if you take seriously, like what the hobbits are doing in terms of entering the more and more wild country as they go west, and the fact that he does actually save them from the Barrow-wights in the Barrow Downs, and there is a sort of recovery of their understanding of the world being older and things coming before them. I mean, it's all sort of like built. It's all about like getting the characters of the hobbits to sort of understand that the world is much bigger than the world that they have lived in, and Tom Bombadil plays a part in that. It is very annoying that he doesn't just like take the ring, but they do make the point in the Council of Elrond that like Bombadil doesn't like exists outside of like any sense of like duty or like, yes, I guess he is like garbage in that sense, but he doesn't really like, he's like neutral. He's just kind of is there.
Yeah, he's fucking Swiss is what he is. You know who sucks? The Swiss. Yeah, he would have been happy to just stay in his little forest home and let darkness roam all over so long as Sauron left him alone. He would have been fine with that. And you know what that is? You know what we call that?
What?
We call that disgusting neutrality. We call that, again, we call it Swissness. Nobody wants to be Swiss.
All right. Okay.
Unless you're a chocolatier or a watchmaker.
All I wanted to say before I was put on trial here about Tom Bombadil, a character I actually don't care that much about.
You love Tom Bombadil. How dare you? You're defending him.
You are
neutral on Tom Bombadil. You're Swiss on Tom Bombadil. I don't appreciate that.
This is the greatest show open we have ever had.
Are you done? Are you done?
No.
No, you're not? Okay.
I'm not done. Take a stand. Are you for or against Bombadil?
I am for including Tom Bombadil in the story.
Against Bombadilism.
I'm against, exactly. I'm anti-Bombadil.
Gonna have to look into your security clearances.
Oh, boom.
Yeah. All I wanted to say about this was that I was struck by the way in which my 8-year-old son interpreted Bilbo's kind of like obsession with the ring that he displays in this argument with Gandalf in the first chapter, which he's like, looks at me and he goes, he's addicted to it, which sort of like shocked me that like he even sort of like understood what addiction is or was. Like, I don't know where he picked that up on, but it was it was the kind of thing that was like very, I thought was very perceptive, for somebody who, like, I'm not always entirely sure he's listening when I'm reading out loud to him. So it was nice. We'll see how it goes. I have a feeling some of the elf songs are going to tax his patience, but we'll see.
Whose patience is not taxed by the singing in all of the Tolkien books? I'm sorry. Like, as much as I enjoyed reading these books as children, those were always pretty quick skips. You know,
what's funny is that they are obviously the parts of the books that Tolkien most enjoyed writing.
Yes, 100%.
Clearly, that's where he was getting himself off.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. So, all right.
Well, that's why he needed an editor to come in there and kill his darlings. Hey, JR, we got another fucking song here.
All right. So I think we should move on. And we should move on to the box office, because there is a story to tell here before Barbie blows up everything at the box office. Number one, last weekend, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part One. Bring in, I guess, in the last weekend. It's a weird thing, right? We talked about this last week because it had this like long tail. But so far it has grossed like $78.5 million. Number two is Sound of Freedom, which we can talk about that very briefly. It like bumped up, which is very strange. And now it made another $27 million, but like bumped, it did better than it had the week before. So, I don't know. What do you want to talk about? Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part One. What do we think about this?
All right. So, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part One, number one movie at the box office. And there were people out there saying, oh, this is a disappointment. You know, this movie should have had a better opening weekend, blah, blah. Look, it had the best first 5 days of any entry in the Mission Impossible series. It has grossed around $250 million worldwide. It is performing very much in line with a Mission Impossible movie. A Mission Impossible movie, certainly the last three before this one, they tend to gross between $200 and $220 million domestic, and between $750 and $800 million worldwide. That is the range that these movies do, and that's about what this movie is in range for right now. I will say that looking at the release calendar and the release schedule, the Paramount has to be kicking themselves for releasing the movie last weekend, because it is, if you look ahead to August, there's a fairly dead patch coming up, and releasing it now gets you stuck between Indiana Jones 5 and Oppenheimer, which has a 3-week, exclusive run on the IMAX screens and everything. So I just think it was a, I think it, I, they have to be looking at this and being like, we have probably cost ourselves $100 million here.
Meaning they should have released it in August.
Released it in August or September. And they would have been much better positioned for a longer run, because I do think it's going to get kind of crushed by Oppenheimer and Barbie this weekend. And frankly, Sound of Freedom is probably taking out a chunk of that audience as well.
Yeah.
But Sound of Freedom is a really interesting story. I mean, I went to go see it, this week, because this is the biggest box office story of the year is this movie. And it was a fascinating experience for a couple of reasons. The box office one is this. So at the end of the movie, so you know how at the beginning of the movies, a lot of the movies these days, you have the director and the actor, the lead actor
as in Mission Impossible.
Like, thanks for coming to the movies. We, you know, this is the best way to experience cinema, is in the theater with other people. You share the experience, blah, blah. Well, at the end of this movie, they have Jim Caviezel. He comes on the screen, like in the basically as a mid-credits tease. And he's like, thanks for coming to the movies. This is the best way to experience a movie. You see it with other people. You can focus on it. You're not pausing, going to the bathroom or on your phone, whatever. It's an important story. We're telling a story. We want people to see it. And we want people who, you know, otherwise might not be able to see the movie, come see it. So you have a chance now to pay it forward. Scan this QR code, and the QR code comes up on the screen. Scan this QR code and pay for a ticket. We'll send it to someone else so they can have an opportunity to see this movie. And I swear to God, hand to God, this really true life happened in front of me. A woman who was leaving the theater heard Caviezel talking, stopped and turned around, like in the exit, you know, the exit hallway,
vestibule,
and was watching this speech. And when the QR code came up, she pulled out her phone and got it on her camera app and clicked it. And as best as I could tell from my vantage point, like three rows back, 100% bought a ticket to pay it forward. I literally saw somebody pay it forward in the theaters.
Well, there you go.
So this movie's going to make this movie's going to end up grossing like $200 million. It's crazy. I firmly believe it will hang on for a while, assuming it is able to hold on to its screens. And I think, judging from what I have been hearing from some folks in exhibition, there is a mild empty seat problem in that like 5% of the tickets or so that are being paid for and, you know, purchased aren't being sat in. But it, like for the most part, it's, you know, packed theaters, for people going to see these movies in places that don't necessarily have packed theaters, like on a Wednesday,
right?
At, you know, 2 p.m. You know, places, it's a lot of South, a lot of the Midwest. So the movie's huge. It's a real hit.
Which is
interesting.
Why would every other studio not do this going forward?
I don't think it makes sense for every other studio going forward, because here's the thing is that the way that this pitch is laid out is this is an important movie. We are trying to spread the message. You, our audience of evangelicals, are used to evangelizing, right? This is like a thing that you do on a regular basis. And this is an extension of that. It's basically an extension of good works, right? So, like, I don't think that works. That doesn't work for Mission Impossible. It doesn't work for a horror movie. It doesn't work for a comedy. It might work for
works for Oppenheimer,
a civil rights picture.
Could work for Barbie.
I don't think it would work for Oppenheimer.
Barbie's.
I don't think. Why would it work for any of these movies? Yeah. Nobody's going to these movies out of a sense of mission.
Okay,
or
so
duty.
What does it cost you to record that? Right. It costs you very, very little, and if you sell $1 million worth of tickets on that, it's worth it.
But you're also if you are a major studio that is spending $100 million on an ad campaign anyway, this looks like kind of cheap skinflint behavior.
Looks
like
thirsty.
part of the pitch of this video, right, is we're Angel Studios. We don't have millions of dollars to put advertising in theater. We have you, our audience, who can help spread the word. I don't think you get away with that in a studio setting. And also, the rest of the studios would fucking make fun of you. You'd get all sorts of you think David Zaslav wants to have people on his yacht who are like, hey, did we pay for this yacht by getting 100,000 people to buy tickets to Barbie? I think it looks like cheap ass behavior if you're a studio doing it.
Hi there, audience. I'm Tom Cruise, and we're trying to save the movies right now. You may have noticed that Hollywood is in a tough spot, nobody actually cares
about that.
Yeah, I agree.
That's not a mission people care about. You know what people care about? People care about child trafficking.
I care more about the movies. And if Tom Cruise or Christopher Nolan came on screen and said, hey, we're trying to save the theatrical experience, I care a lot about the theatrical experience, and I would buy two tickets for somebody else. I would pay it forward twice. And I bet you would too, Sonny, because you care about the theatrical experience, don't you?
No, I wouldn't do that. People can pay for their own tickets. But it doesn't work because, again, this movie is wrapped up. I mean, look, the movie itself is competent, and it's got a very good cast, which does like... It's competently shot. And it has a very good cast, which is like more than 99% of these movies can say. These, you know, kind of Christian studios movies can say. So like that, you know, that gives it basically a pass and a thumbs up there anyway. But like, again, the whole point here is that there's a sense of duty, sense of mission that does not exist in the rest of the world. The other funny thing about this before we get off this. So the trailers for this movie are like visiting an alternate universe. It's very funny. The first trailer was for a movie about the trip to Bethlehem, right? You know, you kind of expect it. Second trailer was for an old man action revenge movie called The Baker, starring Ron Perlman as The Baker. Mm-hmm. And it's about him. It's like Nobody. Remember Nobody? The Bob Odenkirk movie?
Yes.
It's like that, except with Ron Perlman, who is like even older and slower than Bob Odenkirk. But like, so I don't know who's making this movie. Third trailer was for Oppenheimer, which is probably like the best piece of advertising that Oppenheimer is going to get in this entire run, reaching an audience that never comes out to movies. And they're like, hey, here's a movie about America winning World War II. Don't you want to see that?
Right.
Audiences in the South and Midwest. So that was kind of funny. And then the closing were three movies from Angel Studios. The first of which was a Christian sports movie from the writers of Rudy and Hoosier.
Ooh.
Comes a Christian baseball movie. Second was a movie about an Italian woman who is sent to America by the Pope, who then the Pope gets mad at, I think. It's called Cabrini. Is it
a rom-com? Is that how she and the Pope meet?
I don't know exactly. I thought at first it was about a nun, but apparently this is about some entrepreneur woman.
She was a journalist who wanted to have everything. He was the Bishop of Rome.
I don't know.
No, come on.
I don't know what that movie's about, really. I don't know what that
movie's about. You could see them bumping in. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm on my way to mass.
I'm on my way to the church. We gotta make it a pizza pies.
Excuse me. Do you know where St. Peter's Basilica is?
And then the third movie from Angel Studios was, I shit you not, it was a Christian multiverse movie starring Neil McDonough as like
the Shift. Sort of
the Shift. Yes. How do you know about this?
I'm looking it up on Google.
Well, I had never heard of any of these movies before. So like getting all of these trailers one after the other, with the exception of the Oppenheimer one, it was just like, this is a totally different
Christian
I'm in a different
multiverse,
universe.
A contradiction in terms.
JBL, your thinking on this mirrors mine very closely.
Like,
because I was not sure. I'm not sure exactly how this works
in terms.
maybe he's the devil. I don't know. Neil McDonough plays a character called the Benefactor, which sounds very devilish to me. Frankly, I don't think he is, and he wants this character to work with him, or he's gonna keep like It's a Wonderful Life-ing him through the multiverse. Basically, is my understanding.
Isn't like, Sean Astin is in this movie?
Sean Astin is in it. No, but Sean Astin is not playing the lead. The lead is played by some like kind of stereotypically good looking guy. Sean Astin is playing like a supporting character, I think.
Got it.
Anyway, neither here nor there. It was just a very interesting experience all around, from watching the woman pay it forward to like the different trailers. It was all very, very amusing.
All part of your road to Damascus here, Sonny. It's coming. It's coming.
Well,
I don't understand what that means.
Well, why don't we move
on? Why would I go to Syria?
Why don't we move on? Because I'm imagining Wes Anderson doing one of these post-movie, buy a ticket videos. And it's very well done. It's very fussy and perfect. And it will probably sell like another 20 tickets. Asteroid City is the movie we are talking about. It came out a while ago, but we're just getting around to seeing it. Sonny, you want to give us a big boy review of Wes Anderson's new-ish movie, Asteroid City?
Asteroid City. So Asteroid City is the latest from Wes Anderson. It is very Wes Andersonian, very stylized. It's got a lot of the actors who were in his previous.
Would you say it is the films? Most Wes Jason. Anderson Wes Anderson movie?
No, I don't actually think it is. I think Moonrise Kingdom is more specifically Andersonian. In terms of like, I don't like Moonrise Kingdom. I'm one of like four critics on the planet who didn't like Moonrise Kingdom. And I don't like it because it like really plays into his whole dollhouse sensibility in a very real and frustrating way that I didn't care for. I also didn't like how the I didn't like the portrayal of the children in this movie. There was like that weird beach scene always has always squicked me out.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know. I didn't care for that very much. But this is not stereotypically Andersonian in the sense that it is, it's hard even to describe what this movie is without getting really into the weeds. On one level, it's the story of a family that goes to a town in New Mexico where an asteroid landed, and it's about mid-century America and aliens coming and paranoia and all that stuff. But the problem is it's nestled within this, kind of nesting doll structure of what we are watching, what we, the audience, are watching is a television production of a stage play, and we see the making of this stage play in between the acts of the play. The television show is hosted by Bryan Cranston, who's playing kind of a Rod Serling figure, and he is guiding us through this. The play itself, again, which is the meat of the story, is about this family headed by Jason Schwartzman. He comes to Asteroid City with his family so his son can collect a prize as part of the Junior Stargazers. And they meet a bunch of other kind of oddball weirdo families and kids, one of which is this woman, this actress, Midge, who is played by Scarlett Johansson, is kind of a stand-in for Marilyn Monroe. And again, it's about like the family dynamics and how that all works out. But the third layer of the story is, again, watching this play come together. And this is, I think this is Wes Anderson's biggest point, the creative process, how I think, and one of the things that's so frustrating about this movie to me is that I don't have a good enough understanding of mid-century American live theater to talk about this, but the sense I get is that he is showing the evolution of essentially 20 years of American stage play from kind of realism to the method, then to the absurdists. Like you can kind of see that play out in the creation of this play all within one setting. And I don't care enough about it. I don't know enough about it. It's all slightly frustrating to me. And the whole thing doesn't work. There are a lot of really nice little performances in this movie. I could spend 10 minutes just rattling off the names of actors in this movie. But my favorite performance is probably Liev Schreiber. Liev Schreiber plays one of the parents, one of the fathers of one of these junior stargazers who has come to the town. His kid is, you know, he's created like a ray gun. But he like the sense of like a general frustration he has with his kid, who was like always asking to be dared to do things, was very palpably real to me in a way that, you know, I probably shouldn't admit as I am doing now. There's a lot of little things like that in this movie that are great. Tom Hanks is great. He's essentially playing Bill Murray in this movie. He's wonderful. Jason Schwartzman is a great actor. I love Jason Schwartzman. He's fantastic in this. Scarlett Johansson is great. Wes Anderson is the only director who understands how to use Adrian Brody properly. There's lots of little interesting things in this movie that I like. It's just that the whole thing doesn't hang together for me at all. And this is how I feel like some people must have reacted to The French Dispatch.
Right.
The French Dispatch is a movie that is very much about the making of a magazine, and it's structured like a magazine, like a New Yorker or an Atlantic or a Weekly Standard, which is a thing that we all have a lot of experience with and we all like understand intuitively and grasp. And so when people were like, well, I don't get The French Dispatch, I think it's too mannered and too stylized, I didn't like what it's doing, maybe that's just how I feel about this, because I don't care for live theater in general. I know nothing about mid-century American theater. Like at one point I got excited because I was like, oh, Adrian Brody's doing Ilya Kazan, basically.
Right.
That's the thing I recognize. That makes me happy. And like, I feel like if there had been more stuff like that, I would have gotten a little more into it. But I just didn't. It did nothing about this really worked for me.
That's funny. I had the exact.
I mean,
same.
I take it back. Sorry, I take it back. A lot of little things about this movie worked for me, but the whole thing, just as a whole, just didn't work for me at all.
Yeah. As I was watching it, I thought there is a subset of an audience for this that thinks this is the greatest thing ever. And I just don't get it because I am not a theater nerd. And the analogy to French Dispatch is perfect, right? If you have worked in magazines and worked in like general interest kind of magazines, then French Dispatch was, as we said at the time, we all loved it. Like, you know, we fawned over that movie. And we said at the time, we could not understand how anybody else would be interested in it. And, you know, and this is it. Did you like this, Michael?
No. I did not like this movie. And
you liked the French Dispatch or no? You were not with us yet when we did French
Dispatch.
No,
but I love the French Dispatch. For all the reasons that you guys are describing, I would say that I felt like this, I think I texted you guys, it felt like a parody of a Wes Anderson movie to me, Asteroid City did. It like, because I came away with it, and maybe it's because of the same reasons that I just didn't understand the material that it was, the sort of milieu that it was dealing in well enough. Although, like, it's also about sort of Playhouse 90, right? And like sort of mid-century television as well. And like, I've watched the Twilight Zone. I've watched some of this stuff. Like I can appreciate, even if I'm not sort of well-versed in it, I can sort of appreciate that. What I guess made me angry about the movie, or if not angry is too strong a word, but like frustrated with the movie, is how much I loved all of the pieces of it. I loved being in Asteroid City itself. I just thought every detail in classic Wes Anderson form, but I feel like it was almost like he was at the top of his game in terms of creating this setting in such all the details are perfect to me, and not just perfect, but I enjoyed them. It felt like a place I wanted to spend a lot of time in. Like the lettering on the filling station.
Futura.
Exactly. It was great. I loved the,
I assume it's Futura. Cause that's the lettering at all. Yeah.
Some Futura, a clone or similar. I loved the, it was humorous. I loved the performances. I particularly thought Scarlett Johansson was terrific. Like you kind of forget.
She's always terrific.
Yeah.
She's but like, so good.
She is so good, but you, maybe this is unfair of me, but I forget that sometimes. And then like when you see her, you're like, oh yeah, she's a top tier actress. So I loved all those pieces. And then when it was over, my reaction was, well, like, what the fuck was that all about? Like, I just had this
can't
kind
wake
of,
up if you don't fall asleep, Mike.
Like, okay, so that
you have
part,
to give yourself
that is
over.
Terrible.
You have to give that, yourself
that,
over.
That whole part is where the movie lost me completely, where it was just, they just kept saying that over and over again. I'm going like, is this a student film? Like,
well,
what
again,
is this?
So this gets to my point, which is, I think that what we are seeing is the evolution of American theater from naturalism, or like some not really naturalism, like, you know, stage play stuff,
right,
to
like
the method, to the method, which is, you know, works in another specific sort of way, to absurdism, which again, like, breaks the fourth wall. And there's lots of like the thing that has, if I wanted to talk myself into liking this movie, I would focus more on the structure of it and how what I think is actually happening, which is that instead of it being a TV show about a play and the making of the play, the whole thing is actually the play. The whole thing is the play as it was originally presented in 1965 or something, where and that is why Bryan Cranston shows up in like the one shot where he's like, oh, am I not supposed to be here?
Yeah.
And that's why at the end you have the breaking the fourth wall and people chanting at the screen. I think it's all part of a production, and it is all about the making of an artistic endeavor. Like, that is what that's what I think might be going on here. But at the same time, I just don't care enough. I just don't care. I don't care. And I like, I not only did I see this movie twice in theaters, I wanted to give it a fair chance because I love Wes Anderson. I'm like a total, I'm a total sucker for Wes Anderson. I love everything he's done. I think Grand Budapest Hotel is one of the best movies of the 2010s. Yes. You know, I even bought the companion essay book. I'm showing it to the screen right Jeez. Now. Do not detonate. I bought the companion essay book, collecting reference points and influences and that sort of thing. And I read the whole thing cover to cover. And I was like, okay, I understand a little more about the individual things that are going on in this movie. And I still just don't care about it. I don't care what's happening. So
may I offer a couple criticisms? Because I think your read on this is correct, Sonny. And this is the reason Bryan Cranston shows up in that is to tip the hand to the audience that, you know, what you are seeing is the thing as it was originally staged. But qua movie, there are three things that I think are mistakes. The first is the opening voiceover. So the opening of the movie is Bryan Cranston voiceovering and introducing our cast of characters. And it's poorly executed. And I would point to the Royal Tenenbaums as the perfect version of that conceit yeah. within a movie. Right. So I have long, Royal Tenenbaums is one of my favorite movies. And I contend that a very large part of that movie's success is the opening 4 minutes in which Alec Baldwin narrates the cast of characters. Yes. And it's everything about that is perfect from writing to execution. And this one is not. Like, it's just, it's paced wrong. Bryan Cranston's voiceover work is not very good, I don't think. I love Bryan Cranston. He's great. I just don't think it's very good. And maybe it's what Wes Anderson wanted from him. I'm blaming him. But I'm positive that's what Wes Anderson wanted because
right.
the
Wes it's Anderson a very treats, specific thing.
Yeah. Wes Anderson treats his actors like they are dolls, right? I mean, nobody, in this movie, I mean, it's true in most Wes Anderson movies that most of the dialogue is straight to camera. But it is 100% true in this movie, I think. I don't know that there's any dialogue that isn't done straight to camera. And even motion, I don't know that actors ever move unless, you know, they are like, you can feel their feet locked in place unless we are in a tracking shot where they have been told, and now walk stage left, you know. And I think the
color. I'm sorry to interrupt, but just this is why one of my favorite moments is when Liev Schreiber comes crashing through the scene
yeah.
to choke his son.
It's one of the only times. The color palette, I think, is almost annoying to the eye in how bright and washed out it is. Like, I don't know about you guys, but...
Did you see this in a theater or on TV?
No, I saw it on TV. And I really, okay. after a while, I was just like, man, my eyes need a rest from this. It's too... You know, because it's washed out desert. And I get that. Again, right. I understand it. But I think he has not taken consideration of the audiences. And then the whip pans. The extension, which the camera is constantly being pulled left and right and then rotated around. It's a very Wes Anderson thing to do, but it's too much.
Dizzying. It was dizzying.
Yeah, dizzying in ways which are not good, right? I mean, there's dizzying and disoriented, which is good. And then there is like, hey, what you've done is the effect you've created is actually more than you should do for an audience. So I just felt like as a technical piece, this isn't well done. Yeah. But, you know, whatever.
Can I say that, and I texted you guys this because I watched the pre-roll show at the Alamo on this, which was sort of, there was a lot of stuff about Playhouse 90 and all of that, that stuff that's being referenced in this movie. And like, it felt so foreign to me watching it in a way that like other cultural stuff, you know, I mean, like it doesn't like something about this whole idea of like 90 minutes of TV was, you know, every week was being given over to like stage plays and all of the like advertisements and stuff like that. And it brought to mind like the thought that like we still live in the 60s. In the sense that like the way that the 60s like sort of overhauled everything that came before it culture wise, like we're still living in that long tail of, and so that's why it feel, even though it's like only 10 years before, you know, Woodstock. Like, it feels like a completely different, you know, universe. And that may have something to do with just my own, like, not getting it, like, not caring about this world that he's sort of so lovingly, you know, recreating. I didn't understand it.
Do you guys understand the robbers being chased by the police? Because, like, three or four times we get a old Buick being chased by police, a police car and a police motorcycle, with them firing pistols at each other, just blowing through town. It just happens over and over again. And I was like, "What? Why is this?"
I took that to be a visual joke that Wes Anderson thought of and wanted to put in.
Yeah, and the first time, that's what I took it as. Same with the Roadrunner. Right, but the Roadrunner only does the meep once. I mean, he shows up a couple other times, but he just sort of is a puppet. Yeah. I tell you, the one genuine smile I got was when you get the alien, which is a moment that feels a little bit like, do you remember the Coen Brothers movie, The Man Who Wasn't There, which all of a sudden turns into an alien, a UFO movie halfway through? You're like, what the fuck has happened? So when the UFO shows up here and the alien comes down, and the alien is really goofy, and I think it's animated. But when you get the reveal that the alien is played by Jeff Goldblum, then the animation or puppetry done with the alien is really impressive, because you realize that it is moving like Jeff Goldblum. And that made me smile.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, that little callback of like, oh shit, yes, the weird thing that the alien had going on was that it was moving like Jeff Goldblum. I didn't quite realize that. So I don't know. I really smiled at that.
Like, kind of stoop shoulders.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah. No, totally. I think to an extent that a lot of other directors don't quite understand, Wes Anderson handles the physicality of actors extremely well. And this is kind of what I mean when I'm talking about Adrian Brody. He understands how to make Adrian Brody move in a way that is a very specific thing. Like, look back at Grand Budapest Hotel, where he's playing like the kind of Nazi stand-in, count or whatever, and the kind of like stiff-backed arms, shoulders back, striding walk that he has. But also then again here in this movie, where he is a little looser, a little lankier, kind of, understands how to slouch and when to stand up straight. I just like, he understands movement and motion on an actorly basis very, very well.
We haven't mentioned Edward Norton.
I thought he was great. One of my favorite Ed Norton performances, actually.
Right.
Did you guys like him in this or no?
I thought he was fine.
The playwright.
I didn't.
My bringing him up was saying, like, he didn't do anything negative or positive for me. Just, it's like, I almost like kind of forgot about him. So I don't know. What do we think? Is there anything else to say about Asteroid City? I want to like support Wes Anderson because he makes movies his own way.
Here's the thing about a director like this, right? Is that if you give somebody absolute freedom to make exactly what they want to make, sometimes those things are going to be misfires. And I think this is a misfire. I'm in the critical minority here, and I've heard from people who really, really love this movie. It just does nothing for me. It does not work. It really doesn't. And that's okay. I'd rather have an interesting failure from a director I admire than have him make fucking Barbie or something. So
yeah, I totally agree. I was talking about this with somebody. For me, Wes V. Anderson has the highest variance between stuff I love and stuff I really don't enjoy, where he has the highs of Tenenbaums and French Dispatch, and then the lows of Bottle Rocket, which for me is nails on a chalkboard. This,
that's interesting.
Which doesn't quite, now I know, but here's the thing. I think Wes Anderson has highs and lows for most people who love movies, and that our highs and lows are going to be different, because there are people who just think Bottle Rocket is the absolute apex, but they can't stand Fantastic Mr. Fox, right? People who love Moonrise Kingdom, but hate Life Aquatic. And so I find that interesting about Wes Anderson, and I wish him nothing but success.
Yeah,
I do question the decision to release this as a summer movie.
Yeah, it might have made more sense as a October movie. Yeah.
Anyway, no, that's all.
All right. Okay, well, if we don't have anything else, I think that's going to be it for us at the moment. You can go to subbeacon.com where you can subscribe and listen to the bonus episodes when we make them. Thanks for listening.
Michael, how did you gack the first play of the game?
Oh, I was playing second base, and I grounded, it was a grounder, and I threw it to first, and it was a bad throw. It was not that interesting, and I'm not saying it was completely my fault that we gave up 10 runs that inning.
You couldn't have accounted for 10 runs on that, right?
No, but it was okay. The first play would have been the first out. And
it turned into a double instead, or did he get a triple?
No, it just turned into a single. He just had to reach it. Couldn't get the throw.
Come on, man. Give yourself a break.
Oh, but it was bad. It was bad, but, it's fine. It's fine. The big problem we're going to have is that, so our pitcher and his two teenage boys who have been our ringers, they are on vacation for the rest of the season. So,
ooh.
Yeah, we're kind of screwed. So, we shall see. But no, it was, I will say this. I learned a little more about the league and why I've been sort of shocked by how kind of like high level this summer softball league has been. And I found out from my friend and coach who recruited me for this, that this team, which has only been together since last season, was bumped up a level for this summer. And so we're playing. So there's like three levels. There's like literal beginner, there's intermediate, and then there's we're in competitive. And he's like, I don't know why we were bumped up. Maybe they needed an extra team, or they didn't have enough teams, whatever, at the one level. So they just bumped us up. But it makes sense now why, like, we're a bunch of like old over the hill players playing against, guys who are, some of them are maybe less than 10 years out of playing high school baseball, like the disparity. So,
and yet you're playing 500 ball.
We are. We've won, and we're 500. So, and if we get to play the team that we saw following us, because there were two games after our games, then we could even bump up ahead because they were not great. So,
I'm sure it's fine.